From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzek Rallott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. President Hugo Chavez's funeral took place this morning, and comparative political scientist and Latin American democratization expert Charles Kenny returns to the program to discuss the Venezuelan leader's legacy.
In terms of overall economic growth, for the period that he was president, from 1999 to 2012, Venezuela ranks 18th out of 20 Latin American countries, and that's with all this oil revenue.
And the Climate Institute's CEO, John Topping, talks with Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis about rising sea levels and the Arctic.
There are 200 and some native villages that are at some degree of risk on the Alaska coast, where they're threatened by a combination of permafrost thaw and sea level rise.
Hugo Chavez, climate change, and international security, after these news headlines from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rallott. The big news this week was in Latin America, the passing of Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez. And joining us again in the studio for the roundtable is Dr. Charles Kenny. Charlie, you joined us not too long ago to talk about President Chavez's illness. And here we are again, not too long after that, to talk to you about his passing. So you said to us a few weeks ago that Hugo Chavez was likely to soon be a martyr. Has this been the reaction?
Well, one of the most profound and consistent characteristics of Hugo Chavez and his time in power was polarization. Right? He produced in people profound feelings of love and affection and loyalty and of rejection and hate. So for those who loved him, this is a very sorrowful time, and he is indeed, I think, seen as a martyr-like figure.
Well, the vice president and now interim president, Maduro, seemed to kind of use Chavez's health in the last couple of months to gain some of his own support, and actually read a recent story that he has even taken on some of the speech characteristics of Chavez to kind of enhance that. How do you suppose he will continue to do that now that Chavez has passed away and is serving in this kind of martyr role?
Well, I think that as the heir to a martyr, right, one has to lift up the martyr. And so he will do everything in his power to do that. It doesn't really require him to do that in that Chavez is going to have that status regardless. So it's in his best interest to follow along. And that seems to be what he's doing.
Does that make it more difficult for the opposition then, which had gained some support in the October elections and wavered somewhat, as you mentioned before, in December? But how do they then campaign against the martyr that is Hugo Chavez for the next election?
Well, we'll have to see. Elections should be called, but they haven't yet. And until they are, we kind of all bets are off. I think they will be, but they've been announced. The foreign minister said that there would be elections within 30 days, and the Constitution demands that, and so most likely there will. Most people believe that that Maduro has the best chance of winning, no election is a sure thing. And so, yeah, we'll have to see how the opposition takes on that task.
Well, what about Hugo Chavez's legacy? What does he leave behind in terms of his rule of Venezuela, about his relationships in South America, throughout Latin America, with other countries? I mean, the Iranian president actually said something about Hugo Chavez is now resting with Jesus Christ, was really kind of comparing him to Jesus Christ. He's had very close relations with Syria, all the bad guys around the world, I guess, from a U.S. perspective, right? So what is the legacy that he leaves behind?
Well, a complex legacy, I think, in some ways. And I think that this is, again, as he lived his life. There's a quote that's been circulating quite a lot these days of an interview that Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Nobel Prize winner, had with him right at the beginning of his presidency. And at the very end, Garcia Marquez said that he had the impression that he'd had a really interesting conversation with two different people, one of whom seemed to have given by the chances of fate the opportunity to save his country. And the other seemed an illusionist and maybe just another despot. And I think that the polarizing effect of Chavez breaks down along those lines.
He himself is polarized in some ways.
That's right. The people perceive him, those who are his allies, if you will, have seen him as a savior of the country. And perhaps this is the most one of the strongest things is the sense that he gave dignity to whom dignity was denied, that he gave recognition and voice to people who had felt for a long time that they had none. But many others observe the actual effects of his government and see it as an unmitigated disaster in most respects. It is a country that has great oil revenues, and those revenues have been rising quite significantly since he came to power. He came to power with gas or oil at $10 a barrel, right? And we've seen it steadily at over 100 for quite some time. And one can see these revenues rising over time, yet the government's ability to use that money effectively was somewhat limited. They did reduce poverty, and this was something certainly that increased support among the poor. But in terms of overall economic growth, for the period that he was president, from 1999 to 2012, Venezuela ranks 18th out of 20 Latin American countries. Worse only were Guatemala and Haiti. And that's with all this oil revenue. And in terms of reducing inequality, they rank 11th among Latin American countries at the degree to which inequality was reduced during that period of time. So one would have to say that in terms of his objectives, some were gained clearly. He made people feel more recognized. They had better access to some things like some health services and such. So their lives were made palpably better in many ways, and this is one of the reasons they supported them. When you compare that performance with those of his neighbors, however, he did so much less than many of his neighbors with quite a diverse set of ideological preferences and policies. So I think that in terms of the effectiveness of the changes he wanted to make, one would have to say that it was highly ineffective.
So it was interesting. I thought that he was inspired by somebody like Victor Hugo, for example, and Les Miserables. But it sounds like that it's a real mixed bag. That he read that book. He kind of created this his own kind of brand of socialism, and was only partially successful in achieving that. And so, what does that mean then for the future for Venezuela? I mean, are they likely to continue on that path? Or I mean, because I read somewhere that the next leader was going to have to be even more Chavez than Chavez. So, I mean, is that where we're likely to head, or is the kind of the jury still out on that?
Well, I'm not good at predicting, so I don't know really where we're heading. And I think it's hard to know where someone like Maduro might go if he became the president. People in his position sometimes do become harsher than their predecessors, but sometimes they actually, despite all expectations, turn in a very different direction. So I think the jury is out on that, and we'll have to see, first of all, who gets elected and then talk about what their possibilities are. More importantly, perhaps, are the relationships between the countries and how those have evolved, both through organizations he tried to build, like the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas, ALBA, which ended up with just a few countries and not very important ones. So that really didn't go very far. But he has been part of a much bigger movement that really isn't identified with him, but has been very important, of building Latin American organizations that exclude the United States. And so he was part of that, but not the primary mover of that and not the leader of that. And those organizations, I think, are quite important. One thing he may have done in being so extreme in his anti-Americanism and in his rhetoric is to have created a space for moderates. So some people believe that one of his most important effect was to make all of the moderate left in Latin America look very good by comparison. I have a somewhat contrary view to that, not that I disagree with that completely, but there's another side to this, and that's that one of the effects is that the fear of a Chavez-like figure, right, is now quite strong in many people in the region, and that kind of fear in the past has inspired undemocratic actions by the right. And so while he may have made moderates seem more reasonable, I think he's also given justification to people on the right to overreact perhaps in some cases. And perhaps Honduras was a case of this, right, where the political right reacted to the president in a way that could not be explained unless they had seen what Chavez had done and feared that he might be a new Chavez, that kind of thing.
Well, certainly something we're going to continue to watch as we head toward elections perhaps in Venezuela. And we will have you back again, Dr. Kenny, to tell us what to expect then.
Thank you very much. I look forward to that.
If you have a question or comment for our panel, you can send it to us by email at worldviews@ou.edu or send us a tweet at worldviewskgou. Coming up, Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis have a conversation with John Topping. He served as the president and CEO of the Climate Institute since the organization's inception. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot. On Monday, two geographers from UCLA published research indicating the Arctic ice cap could melt enough to make the North Pole a navigable sea route by the year 2050. With us today to talk about the Arctic and international security is John Topping. He's the president and CEO of the Climate Institute and has led the Washington, D.C.-based interest group since its founding in 1986. Before that, he served as the director of the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Air and Radiation under President Ronald Reagan.
John Topping, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you, Rebecca.
We're happy to have you here. In Oklahoma, of course, we've experienced our fair share of tough weather, particularly recently. It seems that we've been getting a number of storms, snow incidents, et cetera. And obviously, this part of the country has been dealing with drought conditions for some time. So is this a pattern that we're going to see into the foreseeable future, or is this just kind of a fluke?
I think the statistical odds of these extreme events will be increasing. No single flood or drought or tornado can be blamed necessarily on climate change. But we know there's going to be climate variability, and humanity is going to be threatened by that. And it doesn't matter which is the cause if you're facing that sort of crisis.
What are some of the statistics that you use in talking about climate change? We hear so much debate about whether it's true that there is climate change or whether it's just a fluke and that things are going to go back to what they were before. How should Oklahomans think about this? Because we've heard everything, and it's rare that we get to speak to somebody who's devoted their entire life to studying this issue.
Well, I wonder if you could add a little bit about what some of the specific risks are that we could potentially be facing, not just here in Oklahoma, but around the world.
Right. Well, first on this whole issue, we're certainly seeing a strong warming trend. I mean, the president of the State of the Union addressed whether one agrees with him or not and other issues. I mean, it was right in the sense that 12 of the last over the last 15 years, we've seen 12 of the warmest years of roughly the last century that we've been taking climate records. I mean, that's incontrovertible. There are thousands of meteorological stations around the world that have essentially fed into that and so on. So there is warming underway. It does seem to be associated with climate change. The risks are that we will see accelerating sea level rise. We've seen a modest amount of sea level rise over the last century. It's possible we could see at this point, it's actually likely we may see as much as 3 feet of sea level rise. And that is going to be a big concern, particularly for the Atlantic and the Gulf Coast of the U.S. and, of course, Small Island nations as well. What's significant, let's say, on the Atlantic coast is for every foot that you see of sea level rise, you're likely to see about 200 times that of shoreline retreat. So if you see, let's say, a 3 foot rise in sea level, that means roughly 900 feet of shoreline are likely to be lost. We can do certain things. We can protect certain cities by building dikes or other seawalls around them. But it means we would lose our pocket beaches in the U.S. And other countries would be facing this.
So what we saw in Manhattan is waiting for us in the future.
Exactly. We actually several years ago did something talking about the big disaster that might happen in New York from a nor'easter and or hurricanes. It was a fascinating thing. It's just posted if one goes on the big on the climate.org site on the Big Apple, and it was remarkably close to what actually happened. We organized a conference in 2006 where we had a number of scientists from schools, particularly in New York, that were looking looking at essentially creating barriers. London has already done some of this to protect itself. And I think some of the major cities may be able to do that. You know, Miami and New York and London and so forth may be able to survive. But you've got a lot of areas, the North Carolina coast, a lot of other areas that are going to find it very difficult. So that's one huge problem. And depending on how much loss we were to see of coastal areas, you could be talking about hundreds of millions of people over the next century who could be forced to move. We're already seeing the first environmental refugees, some of the first actually in the United States, in Alaska. It's essentially native villages. There are 200 and some native villages that are at some degree of risk on the Alaska coast, where they're threatened by a combination of permafrost thaw and sea level rise. There are a number of them that are already looking at relocating from this. So, you know, it's happening. And I think one of the mistakes and climate is to assume that the United States is immune. I mean, I would submit we're probably the most vulnerable of all the industrial countries. I mean, there are a few countries like Bangladesh and Indonesia and Vietnam that perhaps are even slightly more at risk than we are. But we have several risks on the coastal areas, particularly on the Atlantic coast and on the Gulf coast. We have a risk of both storms and also a sea level rise. The sea level rise is a little less of a problem on the Pacific coast because the coast typically are fairly steep there, and the, you know, the shallower the coast, you know, the more the shoreline retreat will be. But still, you know there are concerns there. So that's a problem. But you also have places in the U.S. Southwest where drought, you know, could become a severe problem. You have other places in the country, Oklahoma, Alabama are certainly affected by this, where severe storms inland are a major problem. We don't really know the science yet in terms of tornadoes. You know, it looks likely that hurricane intensity will increase. It's possible tornado intensity will. It seems plausible. But at this point, it's an open research question.
Well, as you mentioned, it is a transnational issue. Even if states like the United States wanted to escape some of these issues related to climate change, it's inescapable. Do you foresee in the future that this will bring states together to cooperate to find solutions, or is this going to create some sort of violence or security concern as resources become scarce and people in large populations start moving in response to some of these threats that you mentioned?
Well, I think the challenge is to bring people together before the crisis is fully upon us. And my hope is that this generation of people who founded Facebook, who've grown up with social media, who started from the time they were practically preschoolers playing games online and so forth, who are going to be profoundly affected by climate change, can be leaders, and they can come together, and we can have maybe 100 million people who can work on these challenges. Maybe not just, you know, spending time doing Angry Birds. They can still do that, and they can do World of Warcraft. But spend maybe an hour or two a week on some practical problem-solving solutions. And if we can create this kind of collective collaboration, that can be more effective than the 200,000 or so of us who run back and forth to meetings on climate and energy and often generate more in emissions than we, you know, we create of solutions. And that's critically missing. You know, we're not doing nearly enough of that. You look after Katrina, where we hundreds of billions of dollars in damage, the government coming in for much of the same thing in Sandy. We spend all sorts of money after the fact. We feel bad for people who've been hit hard. It's very hard to spend small amounts of money in beforehand. It's sort of a little bit the same thing in the healthcare system. We don't spend nearly enough in prevention. We spend a lot in the last 6 months of somebody's life. We need to, in addressing a lot of these challenges such as climate change, we need to do a lot of planning beforehand when things are a whole lot cheaper than they are after the disaster has hit.
Well, the United States has been criticized to some extent for not being more of a player on the international stage in regards to climate change or being proactive. What can the United States do to not only deal with our internal issues regarding climate, but deal with some of the external issues that are going to affect us all?
Well, I think there's several things. We've played a very creative role in pushing reduction of emissions of black carbon, soot, and other so-called short-lived climate forcers, where you can get big human health gains, and you can get benefits from the climate right away. Former Secretary of State Clinton played a very positive role in getting that. 25 countries have moved in that, including some of the big polluting developing countries as well. So we're seeing some progress there. U.S. has played a good role there. We played a very positive role in the Arctic, which is an area that's very threatened. The Arctic Council, where the U.S. is one of the 8 country members, and then there are 6 indigenous tribal organizations that are also members. We can play a very creative role there. So I think this is important. I've worked I'm the chair of a subcommittee of the American National Standards Institute Life Cycle Assessment Committee, where we're looking at a new life cycle assessment that may affect projects, energy development projects in different parts of the world, but particularly undertaken by U.S. companies. And we're looking at the U.S. perhaps having the strongest voluntary standard for these major project life cycle standards of any country in the world that would be factoring in emissions to the Arctic, looking at effects on the Arctic and an ocean acidification, where if this gets adopted in the U.S., and we're hoping this will be adopted by later this year, it's been out for public comment, and now we're moving toward a formal submission of this. If this happens, it could become the basis for an international standards organization that would govern major projects. So companies that wanted to get a kind of green label would look at this. And there's very strong interest in Scandinavia and some other countries in moving if the U.S. does adopt the standard. And it's largely a voluntary standard. But sometimes the advantage of voluntary standards, if they affect major projects, is they can come in 10 years faster than EPA regulations, which everybody sues over and so forth. And so I'm optimistic that the U.S., even though I don't see a lot of action coming out of Congress in Washington, can move. It's also significant on black carbon there is a kind of political consensus. It was interesting. Earth Day, April 22nd in 2009, almost 4 years ago, Senator Inhofe, who's generally been a climate skeptic, and Senator Kerry, and Senator Boxer, and Senator Carper all joined together in sponsoring legislation to ask the EPA, U.S. EPA, to do an analysis of reductions of soot or black carbon and their potential effects here and abroad. The U.S. EPA did this, and it's a remarkably positive standard, and it's helped in some of the work that's now happening through the Climate and Clean Air Coalition. So that's something where even people who are climate skeptics breathe air just as other people do, and I think that's critical to make these things happen.
Well, we'll go ahead and end on that positive note. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
That was John Topping, the president and CEO of the Climate Institute. You can find a link to the study of sea routes through the North Pole we mentioned earlier in the program on our website, kgou.org. The University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies produces Worldviews through a partnership with KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces our show and manages the show's webpage. And Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview. For Rebecca Cruz, Charles Kenny, and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grolot.